This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Change Your Brain, Change Your Life. Revised and Expanded, 2015. The Breakthrough Program for Conquering Anxiety, Depression, Obsessiveness, Lack of Focus, Anger, and Memory Problems. This is the author, Dr. Daniel G. Amen. Preface to the new edition. Since Change Your Brain, Change Your Life was first published in 1998, so much has changed both in the field of neuroscience and at Amen Clinics. Our clinical experience in diagnosing, treating, and optimizing the brain has grown exponentially. We've expanded from one local clinic serving the people in Northern California to a nationwide group of clinics treating children, teenagers, and adults from 111 countries. Our database of brain SPECT, single photon emission computed tomography studies, the primary functional brain imaging study we use at Amen Clinics, has grown from about 5,000 scans in 1998 to well over 100,000 scans in 2015. Making us one of the world leaders in applying brain imaging science to help people who struggle with emotional issues such as anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder, behavioral challenges like addictions, weight control, or anger, cognitive problems such as brain fog or memory issues, and learning challenges including attention deficit disorder, ADD, also called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. When Change Your Brain, Change Your Life was first written, the medical staff at Amen Clinics prescribed more psychiatric medications than we do today. Whenever feasible, we choose more natural ways to heal and support the brain, such as supplements and lifestyle interventions, nutrition, exercise, new learning, and so forth. While we still use medications when needed and believe they save lives when used appropriately, we firmly believe that treatment providers should first do no harm and use the least toxic, most effective treatments. It's not uncommon that a new patient will come for their first visit at Amen Clinics on 4, 5, or 8 different medications, and unsurprisingly, they're still suffering. One child actually came to our Reston, Virginia clinic on 17 different medications. We spend more time taking people off medications than putting them on new ones. Most of our new patients have never been offered healthy lifestyle or natural supplement options before coming to see us. At the time of this writing, Amen Clinics has published more than 60 scientific studies since the first edition of this book on a wide range of topics from traumatic brain injury in professional football players to brain trauma, obesity, suicide, predicting treatment response for patients with ADHD, meditation, and the impact of nutritional supplements on the brain. In 2014 alone, we published or presented 20 new studies. Some of the concepts I wrote about in the original version of this book have changed as our experience has expanded and new research has been published. Of course, the core belief of the original book is still as valid today as it was in 1998. You are not stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. You can change your brain and your life. In the last 17 years, we've developed and refined the method we use at Amen Clinics, the Amen Clinics method, which I'll explain in detail so you can benefit from it without ever stepping through the door of one of our clinics. One of my favorite examples of how you can change your brain, change your life, is our work with professional football players. Starting in 2009, Amen Clinics performed the first and still largest brain imaging study on active and retired NFL players at a time when most people were ignoring this critical issue. Our research demonstrated high levels of damage in players, which was not a big surprise. Most thoughtful 9-year-olds would probably think it is a bad idea to repeatedly hit the organ that runs your life, even with a helmet on. But what really excited us was that on the Amen Clinic's Brain Smart program, the same one I'll discuss in this book, 80% of our players showed significant improvement, especially in the areas of blood flow, mood, and memory. In 2010, Pastor Rick Warren asked me and Dr. Mark Hyman to collaborate on creating a health program for Saddleback Church, which has one of the largest congregations in the world. Pastor Warren had seen me on public television talking about the dinosaur syndrome, a term I coined to describe new research that reported as your weight goes up, the actual physical size and function of your brain goes down. Big body, little brain, you are going to become extinct if you don't get your weight under control. That got Pastor Warren's attention. Together, the three of us created the Daniel Plan, a revolutionary 5-step program to get the world healthy through religious organizations, faith, food, fitness, focus, and friends. The first week, 15,000 people signed up for our program. Over the first year, they lost 250,000 pounds combined, more than a space shuttle weighs. Even better, participants reported better energy, focus, creativity, sleep, memory, and mood, along with reductions in stress, blood pressure, blood sugar, sexual dysfunction, and many medications. The Daniel Plan is now being implemented in thousands of churches around the world, from Hong Kong to Johannesburg, Manila to São Paulo. Another feature of this edition is a focus on getting you physically healthy. I don't want you to be a dinosaur. In addition, we developed the Brain Warrior concept, which you'll hear about throughout the book. As I work to get myself and those I serve truly healthy, it is clear to me that we are in a war for the health of our brains. Virtually everywhere we go, someone is tempting us with bad food that will kill us early, putting toxic thoughts in our minds by pushing us to watch horrific news events over and over, or working to addict us to the latest gadgets that interfere with our relationships. To achieve optimal mental performance, we have to have the mindset of a brain warrior. Over the last 17 years, I've had the opportunity to present the information in this book to millions of people. My 10 national public television specials have aired more than 80,000 times across North America. I've also been blessed to talk to medical and mental health professionals, judges, and government officials around the world, including those at the National Security Agency, NSA, the National Science Foundation, NSF, Harvard's Learning and the Brain Conference, the Department of the Interior, the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and the Supreme Courts of Delaware, Ohio, and Wyoming. I've spoken at medical schools and participated in debates about brain imaging at national medical meetings. This edition of Change Your Brain, Change Your Life offers you the latest research and thinking at Amen Clinics to help boost your brain and the brains of those you love, which will in turn improve everything in your life and theirs. Part 1. How imaging changes everything. Your brain, a brief primer. Your brain is the most amazing organ in the universe. It is the organ responsible for learning, strategizing, loving, creating, and behaving. As such, it's important to know about it, love it, and maybe even be a bit obsessed with it. The human brain typically weighs about 3 pounds and is the consistency of soft butter. It is housed in a really hard skull that has multiple sharp bony ridges. Therefore, it might not surprise you to learn that your brain was not designed to be inside a cranium that hits soccer balls or in a ring with a mixed martial artist who wants to pound it senseless against the canvas. The brain is an integrated whole, a symphony of parts that work together to create and sustain life. Specific parts of the brain are designed to do certain things, but its functions are rarely simple. With that in mind, some generalizations can help you learn about your brain. The largest structure in the human brain is the cerebral cortex, the wrinkly, walnut-shaped mass that sits atop and covers the rest of the brain. The cerebral cortex has 4 main areas, or lobes, on each side of the brain: frontal, temporal, parietal, and occipital. The frontal lobes consist of the motor cortex, which is in charge of directing movement. The premotor cortex, which helps to plan movement, and the prefrontal cortex, PFC, which is considered the executive part of the brain. The PFC is the most evolved part of the human brain and is involved with focus, forethought, judgment, organization, planning, impulse control, empathy, and learning from mistakes. It makes up about 30% of the human brain, compared to just 11% for chimpanzees, 7% for dogs, 3% for cats, perhaps why they need 9 lives, and 1% for mice, which is why they are eaten by cats. Deep in your frontal lobes is the anterior cingulate gyrus, ACG, a structure involved with error detection and shifting attention. The temporal lobes, located underneath your temples and behind your eyes, are involved with mood stability, emotional reactions, temper control, learning, moving memories into long-term storage, and auditory processing. The temporal lobes have been called the what pathway because they name what things are. The parietal lobes at the top side and back of the brain are the centers for sensory processing, touch, perception, and sense of direction. Called the where pathway because they help us know where things are in space, they're also involved in manipulating numbers, dressing, and grooming. The occipital lobes at the back of the cortex are concerned primarily with vision and visual processing. Sitting underneath the cerebral cortex is the limbic or emotional system, the part of the brain that colors our emotions and is involved with bonding, nesting, feeding, sexuality, and emotions. Also underneath the cortex are structures called the basal ganglia, involved with motivation, pleasure, and smoothing motor movements. The cerebellum at the back bottom part of the brain is involved with motor and thought coordination. It is essential for processing complex information. The cortex is divided into 2 hemispheres, left and right. While the 2 sides significantly overlap in function, the left side, in right-handed people, is generally the seat of language and tends to be the analytical, logical, detail-oriented part of the brain, while the right hemisphere sees the big picture and is likely involved more with hunches and intuition. It is often opposite in left-handed people. Information from the world enters your brain through your limbic or emotional system, where it tags the information as meaningful, safe, or dangerous. Then it travels to the back part of the brain, temporal, parietal, and occipital lobes, where it is initially processed and compared with past experience, and then to the front part of the brain for you to consider and then act on it. The transmission of information from the outside world to your conscious awareness in the front part of your brain happens almost instantaneously. Introduction. The single most important lesson I've learned from looking at more than 100,000 brains. To start the book, I'd like to share the single most important lesson I've learned from looking at more than 100,000 brain scans. But first, let me put it into a little context. I am in the middle of 7 children. When I was growing up, my father called me a maverick, which to him was not a good thing. In 1972, the Army called my draft number, and I was trained as an infantry medic, which gave birth to my love of medicine. I quickly learned that I hated the thought of being shot at or sleeping in the mud, so I got myself retrained as an X-ray technician and developed a passion for medical imaging. As our professors used to say, how do you know unless you look? In 1979, when I was a second-year medical student, someone in my family tried to kill herself, and I took her to see a wonderful psychiatrist. I came to realize that if he helped her, which he did, it would not only save her life, but it could also help her children and even her future grandchildren, as they would be shaped by someone who is happier and more stable. This realization helped me fall in love with psychiatry because I recognized its potential to change generations of people. Fast forward to 1991, when I attended my first lecture on brain SPECT, single photon emission computed tomography imaging, given by Dr. Jack Pauldy, the chief of medicine at our local hospital. At the time, I was in private practice in Northern California and the director of a psychiatric addiction treatment program. Dr. Pauldy presented SPECT as a tool that could give psychiatrists more information about the brain to help them better diagnose and treat their patients. SPECT is a nuclear medicine study that looks at blood flow and activity. It's different from traditional CT and MRI scans, which are anatomy studies that look at the brain's structure. SPECT looks at brain function and basically tells us 3 things about its activity: good activity, too little activity, or too much activity. It also helps to show if the brain has been hurt from physical trauma or if it has been exposed to toxins or infections. In this book, I will talk about 2 types of SPECT images: surface views and active views. Surface views look at the outside surface of the brain and show areas of healthy and low activity. Active views show areas of high or increased activity in the inner areas of the brain. Throughout the book, I will talk about dozens of brain SPECT images, which will help you visualize how disease and trauma affect our brains. In a healthy scan, the surface images show full, even, symmetrical activity. The surface scans look at the top 45% of brain activity. Anything below that threshold shows up as a hole or a dent. The scan images with holes that I will talk about throughout the book are generally not missing parts of the brain. Rather, the holes indicate low activity in those regions. In a healthy, active scan, the back part of the brain is typically the most active. If we look at a healthy scan compared to someone who had 2 strokes, you will see 2 areas that look like holes of low activity. The SPECT scan of someone with Alzheimer's disease will show that the back half of the brain is deteriorating. The SPECT scan of a person with traumatic brain injury will show decreases where the trauma occurred. As you know, your brain is soft and your skull is really hard. When you hit your head, your brain slams into the bony ridges on the inside of the skull. The scan of someone with a substance abuse problem will show overall decreased activity that often looks like Swiss cheese. Beyond the myriad of problems drug use can cause, it also results in brain damage. A person with obsessive-compulsive disorder will typically show too much activity in the front part of the brain, so people have trouble turning off their thoughts. In epilepsy, we often see focal areas of increased activity. In 1992, I attended an all-day lecture on brain SPECT imaging in psychiatry given by physicians at Creighton University and sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. The experience was amazing, and the results they shared mirrored my own early experience with SPECT. Yet at the same conference, researchers complained loudly that clinical psychiatrists like me should not be using the scans in their practices. They were only for research purposes. Being a maverick, I didn't hesitate to speak up and challenge their position. Psychiatrists then, and even now, are the only medical specialists who virtually never look at the organ they treat. Think about it. Cardiologists, neurologists, gastroenterologists, orthopedic doctors, in fact, every other medical specialist look, psychiatrists guess. Before imaging, I was throwing medication-tipped darts in the dark at my patients and had unintentionally hurt some of them, which horrified me. There is a reason that most psychiatric medications have black box warnings. Give them to the wrong person, and you can precipitate a disaster. Without the benefit of looking, psychiatric outcomes have not improved in decades. Thomas Insull, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, wrote, "The unfortunate reality is that current medications help too few people to get better and very few people to get well. For the antidepressants, the rate of response continues to be slow and low. In the largest effectiveness study to date, with more than 4,000 patients with major depressive disorder in primary care and community settings, only 31% were in remission after 14 weeks of optimal treatment. In most double-blind trials of antidepressants, the placebo response rate hovers around 30%. The unfortunate reality is that current medications help too few people to get better and very few people to get well. In fact, recent studies that looked at the published data from the pharmaceutical companies on antidepressant trials and the unpublished data obtained from the Freedom of Information Act and the pharmaceutical companies found that antidepressants, except for the most severely depressed patients, worked no better than placebos or sugar pills. Without imaging, psychiatrists are forced to make diagnoses like they did in 1840 when Abraham Lincoln was depressed. I love Lincoln for his psychological mindedness and his perseverance despite many failures. Most people don't know that when Lincoln was 10 years old, he was kicked in the head by a horse and knocked unconscious for hours. People thought he was dead. Subsequently, and perhaps relatedly, Lincoln suffered severe bouts of depression in his life, even to the point of being suicidal. After personal and political setbacks in the winter of 1840, Lincoln went to see his physician, Anson Henry. How did Dr. Henry diagnose Lincoln's melancholy? He used tools that were state-of-the-art in 1840. He talked to him, observed him, and looked for symptom clusters to try to understand what was wrong. That is exactly how most psychiatric diagnoses are made in 2015, 175 years later, using a symptom cluster manual called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, published by the American Psychiatric Association. In most family physician, pediatrician, psychiatrist, psychologist, or therapist offices, patients report symptoms, and then doctors give them a diagnosis based on those symptoms. For example, if a patient says, "I'm depressed," they are likely to get a diagnosis of depression and prescribed an antidepressant medication or psychotherapy for depression. If a patient complains of being anxious, he or she will likely get an anxiety disorder diagnosis and medicine or therapy for anxiety. Or if a patient has attentional problems, he or she often gets a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD and put on medicine to help with focus or impulse control. Or my favorite diagnosis to explain this diagnostic phenomenon is that if a patient tells the doctor that he or she has temper problems or explodes intermittently, he or she often gets a diagnosis called intermittent explosive disorder, IED. The acronym is ironic, like improvised explosive device in war, and put in anger management classes. None of these diagnostic labels tell us one thing about the underlying biology of these problems, and so people end up with one-size-fits-all treatment plans, which is the cause of many treatment failures. In a major lecture in 2005 to the American Psychiatric Association, Insel said, "The current way psychiatrists diagnose patients using the DSM is 100% reliable." Meaning that if you diagnose someone using the DSM criteria today, you will likely diagnose them the same way tomorrow. But it is 0% valid, because it is not based on any underlying neuroscience. Essentially, Insel was saying that the emperor of psychiatric diagnosis, the DSM, had no clothes. This statement struck a chord with me, because at Amen Clinics, we were already working beyond the DSM with good results. The imaging work we were doing taught us so many important lessons. One of the first lessons was that symptom clusters like ADD, ADHD, anxiety, depression, and addictions are not single or simple disorders in the brain, and they all have multiple types. For example, if we look at two patients with depression, one may have really low activity in the brain, another may have really high activity. Do you think they'll respond to the same treatment? Of course not. Treatment needs to be tailored to individual brains, not a cluster of symptoms. Over the years, I've described 7 types of ADD or ADHD, 7 types of anxiety and depression, 6 types of addicts, and 5 types of overeaters. Another important early lesson was that mild traumatic brain injuries are a major cause of psychiatric illness that ruins people's lives, and very few people know about it, because only a handful of psychiatrists ever look at the brains of their patients. I remember the scan of a 15-year-old boy who fell down a flight of stairs at the age of 3. Even though he was unconscious for only a few minutes and was given a diagnosis of mild traumatic brain injury, there was nothing mild about the enduring effect the injury had on his life. I met him after he'd been kicked out of his 3rd residential treatment program for violence. Neither medication nor behavior therapy was the answer. He needed a brain rehabilitation program, which I will discuss in part 3. Throughout our imaging work, I've discovered that many people forget they had significant brain injuries, and I have to ask them the "did you ever have a brain injury" question 5 to 10 times to uncover if they had one or not. I have to specifically ask people if they've ever fallen out of a tree, dove into a shallow pool, fell off a fence head first, been in a car accident, or had concussions playing sports. I was shocked by the percentage of people who initially said no to the question about brain injury, but when we saw evidence of an injury on a scan and prodded them, they begin to remember all sorts of incidents, like going through a windshield of a car, falling off a cliff, or falling out of a third-story window. As we continued our work with SPECT, the criticism from researchers grew louder, but so did the lessons. Judges and defense attorneys sought our help in trying to understand criminal behavior. To date, we have scanned over 500 convicted felons, including 90 murderers. Our work taught us that many people who do bad things often have troubled brains. That was not a surprise. But what did surprise us was that many of these people had brains that could be rehabilitated. Here is a radical idea I recently discussed with a group of judges in Georgia. What if we evaluated and treated troubled brains rather than simply warehousing them in toxic, stressful environments? In my experience, we could potentially save tremendous amounts of money by making a significant percentage of these people more functional so that when they got out of prison, they could work, support their families, and pay taxes. Dostoevsky once said, "A society should be judged not by how it treats its outstanding citizens, but by how it treats its criminals." Instead of just crime and punishment, SPECT imaging taught me that we should also be thinking about crime evaluation and treatment. After a quarter century and more than 100,000 SPECT scans, the single most important lesson my colleagues and I have learned is this: you can literally change people's brains. And when you do, you change their lives. You are not stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better, and we can prove it. I remember seeing the scan of an ADD teenager who had been cutting herself, failing in school, and fighting with her parents. Her initial scan showed really low activity, especially in the front part of her brain. With the right treatment, the low activity in her brain became much better, and she went from D's and F's to A's and B's, and was much more emotionally stable. Ray and Nancy. Ray came to see us as part of our NFL study. He played linebacker for the San Diego Chargers in the early 1970s. Part of Ray's motivation for participating in our study was that his wife Nancy had been recently diagnosed with frontal temporal lobe dementia, and he wanted us to evaluate her as well. He was upset at the physician who diagnosed Nancy because he told Ray that within a year, she would not know who he was or his name. When we evaluated Ray, he showed evidence of brain trauma, as did almost all of our retired players. Plus, he was overweight. Nancy's scan was a disaster. She had severe decreased activity in the front part of her brain, consistent with the diagnosis of frontal temporal lobe dementia. When we sat down to review their scans, it was very emotional for Ray and Nancy, and for me too. From our clinical experience, We knew we could help Ray. But there is still no known effective treatment for frontal temporal lobe dementia. Our strategy with cases like Nancy's is to do everything we can to try to slow or reverse the dementia process. And certainly it does not always work. I told Ray and Nancy that it was critical to immediately start our brain rehabilitation program, which will be outlined in part 3 of the book. 10 weeks later, I saw them back for their first follow-up visit. Nancy's follow-up scan showed dramatic improvement. Nancy had followed through on all of our recommendations. In addition to her improved scan, her memory and cognitive function were better. Ray joked that we had to slow down because soon enough, she would be smarter than he was. In addition, Ray had lost 30 pounds. He said his motivation was helping his wife. If he did everything we suggested, then she would too. They would do it as a couple. Sometimes, motivation is about love. Ray loved Nancy. Nancy's scans took place in early February and May 2010. 5 years later, Nancy still knows Ray's name. I have no doubt we are in a war for the health of her brain. Both Ray and Nancy have become brain warriors. Becoming a brain warrior. Helping to pioneer the clinical application of brain imaging in psychiatry has been the greatest personal and professional challenge of my life. In 1993, when I first started to talk at medical meetings about the discoveries we were making at Amen Clinics, many of my colleagues criticized and belittled me. The lack of focus on this exciting technology bothered me deeply, but did not dissuade me from using it in my work. What I was seeing in the brain was real, and the new knowledge changed the lives of many of my patients. But I hated the fight. In 1994, I decided to start keeping a low profile, expecting others would do the research and move the profession forward. Then in April 1995, 9-year-old Andrew came into my clinic. Andrew had been a happy, sweet boy until about a year and a half before he came to see me. Then his personality changed. He appeared depressed. He had aggressive outbursts, and he complained to his mother of both suicidal and homicidal thoughts, very abnormal for a 9-year-old. He drew pictures of himself hanging from a tree and shooting other children. When he attacked a little girl on the baseball field for no particular reason, his mother, Sherry, called in tears. Andrew was Columbine, Aurora, and Sandy Hook waiting to happen. I told Sherry to bring Andrew in the next day, and they bundled him into the car for an 8-hour drive. As I sat with Andrew's parents, and then with Andrew, I knew something wasn't right. He looked angry and sad. He had no explanation for his behavior. He did not report any form of abuse. Other children were not bullying him. There was no family history of serious psychiatric illness. He had not sustained a recent head injury. The vast majority of my psychiatric colleagues would have placed Andrew on some sort of medication and sent him to see a counselor for psychotherapy, as they did for the Columbine shooter Eric Harris or the Springfield, Oregon killer Kip Kinkle. Having performed more than 1,000 spec studies by that time, I first wanted a picture of Andrew's brain. I wanted to know what we were dealing with. But with the criticism from my colleagues swirling in my own brain, I did wonder if Andrew's problems weren't completely psychological. Perhaps there was a family problem that I just didn't know about. Maybe Andrew was acting out because his older brother was a perfect child who did well in school and was very athletic. Maybe Andrew had these thoughts and behaviors to ward off feelings of insecurity related to being the second son in a family. I had personal knowledge of this scenario. Maybe Andrew wanted to feel powerful, and these behaviors were associated with issues of control. Then logic took over my brain. 9-year-old children do not normally think about suicide or homicide. They do not attack little girls for no apparent reason. I needed to scan his brain. If it was normal, then we would look further for underlying emotional problems. I went with Andrew to the imaging center and held his hand while he held his teddy bear and got scanned. As his brain appeared on the computer screen, I thought there had been a technical mistake. The image of Andrew's brain had no left temporal lobe. Upon quick examination of the complete study, I realized the quality of the scan was fine. He was indeed missing his left temporal lobe. Did he have a cyst, a tumor, a prior stroke? Part of me felt fear for him as I looked at the monitor. But the diagnostician in me felt relieved that we had some explanation for his aggressive behavior. My research, and the research of others, had implicated left temporal lobe problems with aggression. The next day, Andrew had an MRI, an anatomical brain study, which showed a cyst, a fluid-filled sac, about the size of a golf ball, occupying the space where his left temporal lobe should have been, pushing it inside and raising his intracranial pressure. I knew the cyst had to be removed. However, getting other medical professionals to take this seriously proved very frustrating. Andrew and his missing left temporal lobe. The day of the MRI, I called Andrew's pediatrician and informed him of the clinical situation and brain findings. I told him to find the best person possible to drain the cyst. He contacted 3 pediatric neurologists. All of them said that Andrew's negative behavior was probably not in any way related to the cyst in his brain, and they would not recommend operating on him until he had real symptoms. When the pediatrician relayed this information, I became furious. Real symptoms? I had a child with homicidal and suicidal thoughts who was losing control over his behavior and attacking people. I contacted a pediatric neurologist in San Francisco who told me the same thing. I then called a friend of mine at Harvard Medical School, also a pediatric neurologist, who told me the same thing. She even used the words real symptoms. I practically jumped down her throat. How could Andrew's symptoms be more real? Oh, Dr. Amon, the neurologist replied, when I say real symptoms, I mean symptoms like seizures or speech problems. Could the medical profession really not connect the brain to behavior? I was appalled. But I wasn't going to wait until Andrew killed himself or someone else. My next call was to pediatric neurosurgeon Jorge Lazareff at UCLA, who told me that he had operated on 3 other children with left temporal lobe cysts who had all been aggressive. He had wondered if it was related. Thankfully, after evaluating Andrew, he agreed to remove the cyst. After the surgery, I received 2 calls. The first one was from Sherry. She told me that the surgery went well, and when Andrew woke up, he smiled at her. It was the first time he had smiled in a year. The next call was from Dr. Lazareff, who said, "Oh my God, Dr. Amon, the cyst was so aggressive and had put so much pressure on Andrew's brain that it had actually thinned the bone over his left temporal lobe. If Andrew had been hit in the head by a ball, it would have killed him instantly. Either way, in 6 months, he would have been dead." It's a day I'll never forget, not just because I fought for a patient, but because Andrew is my nephew and godson. A year later, Andrew and I were on vacation together with our families in Hawaii. After an afternoon of snorkeling, we stopped at a local place for something to drink. As he was sipping from a straw, Andrew looked up at me with his beautiful brown eyes and long curly hair, and asked me why he had the cyst. Our family has deeply rooted spiritual beliefs, and when Andrew asked me why, I started to cry. In my soul, I felt I knew why it happened to him. So I would stop being so damn anxious, scared, and worried about what others thought of me, and just do the work I was given to do. There were too many children, teenagers and adults like Andrew, who had clear brain abnormalities, whom society was just writing off as bad human beings. Since Andrew, I have helped 43 other children and young adults with temporal lobe cysts, many of whom exhibited aggressive or violent behavior. Andrew was blessed in the sense that he had someone who loved him, paying attention to his brain when his behavior was off. Now, 18 years later, Andrew is employed, owns his own home, and pays taxes. Because someone looked at his brain, he has been a wonderful son and will be a better husband, father, and grandfather. When you have the privilege of changing someone's brain, you not only improve his or her life, you have the opportunity to affect generations to come. This book will teach you that human behavior is much more complex than society's damning labels would have us believe. We are far too quick to attribute people's actions to a bad character when the source of their actions may not be their choice at all, but a problem with brain physiology. One young man, for example, who was brought in to see me after being released from prison for violent outbursts, had a temporal lobe problem that responded positively to targeted treatment. How many bad people sitting in prison would prove to be perfectly nice people with the right treatment? Sometimes people aren't being loving, industrious, cheerful, peaceful, obedient, or kind, not because they wouldn't like to be, but because something is wrong with their brain, something that is potentially fixable. Until the late 1980s, physicians had no sophisticated tools for evaluating a working brain. Standard MRI, magnetic resonance imaging scans, and CAT, computerized axial tomography scans, available since the 1970s, are anatomical studies, and although they can evaluate what a brain looks like physically, they cannot provide information on how well the brain is working. Functional brain imaging studies like SPECT, positron emission tomography, PET, functional MRI, fMRI, and quantitative EEGs, QEEGs, give much more useful information. Each of these functional studies have advantages and disadvantages. At this time, in my opinion, due to cost, ease of use, and our more than 100,000 scan database, SPECT is our diagnostic tool of choice. It is important to note that having an abnormal SPECT scan is not an excuse for bad behavior. SPECT adds to our knowledge about and understanding of behavior, but it does not provide all the answers. Many people who have difficulties in their brains never do anything harmful or destructive to others. Each scan needs to be interpreted in the context of each individual life. Not all scientists will agree with every finding in this book. The information here is based largely on our extensive clinical experience and research. In this edition, I provide hundreds of references, sources, and additional reading for those interested. You do not need a SPECT scan to benefit from this book. In fact, if you go to a medical center that has little experience with SPECT, the results are not likely to mean much to your doctor. My goal is to show you what we have learned from SPECT to help explain a wide variety of human behaviors. Many problems long thought of as psychological in nature, depression, panic disorders, ADD, ADHD, have, at least in part, biological roots that need to be addressed with an effective treatment plan. I hope that by providing new insights into how the brain works, you'll gain a deeper understanding of your own feelings and behaviors and the feelings and behaviors of others. To help you be more effective in your day-to-day life, I hope you will use the brain-based prescriptions that are relevant for your brain issues or brain type. Chapter 1. 12 Principles to Change Your Brain and Your Life. At Amen Clinics, we have 12 core principles that provide the foundation of our work with patients suffering from a range of issues, as well as those looking to optimize their brains. They are incredibly simple, but don't let that fool you. They are also extremely powerful and will change everything in your life if you read, understand, and apply them. 1. Your brain is involved in everything you do and everything you are, including how you think, how you feel, how you act, and how well you get along with other people. Your brain is the organ behind your intelligence, character, personality, and every single decision you make. This is not a new idea. In about 400 BC, Hippocrates wrote, "And men ought to know that from the brain, and from the brain only, arise our pleasures, joy, laughter, and jests, as well as our sorrows, pains, despondency, and tears. And by this, in a special manner, we acquire wisdom and knowledge, and see and hear and know what is foul and what is fair, what is bad and what is good, what is sweet and what is unsavory. And by the same organ, we become mad and delirious, where fears and terrors assail us. All these things we endure from the brain when it is not healthy. In these ways, I am of the opinion that the brain exercises the greatest power in the man. This is the interpreter to us of those things which emanate from the air when the brain happens to be in a sound state. It is your brain that decides whether you should get married and if you get divorced. It is your brain that manages your money and helps you be successful at work. And it is your brain that pushes you away from the table, telling you that you've had enough, or that gives you permission to have the third bowl of ice cream. Yet most people never really think about their brains, which is a huge mistake, because success in anything you do starts with a healthy brain. 2. When your brain works right, you work right. But when your brain is troubled, you are much more likely to have trouble in your life. With a healthy brain, you are happier, physically healthier, because you make better decisions, wealthier, also because you make better decisions, and more successful in everything you do. When your brain is unhealthy, for whatever reason, brain injuries, drug abuse, obesity, sleep apnea, mold toxicity, etc., you are sadder, sicker, poorer, and less successful. In all the books about success on the shelf at your local bookstore, virtually none of them talk about optimizing the physical health of your brain. Based on our work with tens of thousands of people, we believe it is always the first place to start. If you really understand principle number 2, it can be disturbing because it directly challenges the notion of free will. Most people think of free will as black or white. You have it or you don't. Our imaging work has taught me that free will is a gray concept. Some of us have great overall brain function and likely have a very high percentage of free will, while others, often through no fault of their own, such as having been in a car accident, have less healthy brains, leading to less free will and more troubled lives. 3. Your brain is the most amazing, energy-hungry organ in the universe. It is estimated that your brain has 100 billion cells, with each one connected to other cells by up to 10,000 individual connections. It has also been estimated that you have more connections in your brain than there are stars in the universe. Let's put this in binge-watching television terms. It's been estimated that the brain has the storage capacity of 3 million hours of TV shows. Even though your brain is only about 2% of your body's weight, about 3 pounds, it uses 20 to 30% of the calories you consume and 20% of your body's blood flow. Take a moment to consider that. Your brain is the most metabolically expensive real estate in your body. This is important to understand because any form of oxygen deprivation state, from a scary event like a near-drowning episode, to the seemingly commonplace like having sleep apnea, can damage your brain. 4. Your brain is the consistency of soft butter and housed in a really hard skull with multiple sharp bony ridges, making it easily injured. Think of something that falls in between jello and egg whites on the softness spectrum. That's your brain. Now imagine it encased in a really hard skull with many sharp bony ridges. Jarring motions and head injuries can cause the brain to slam into the hard interior of the skull, causing brain injuries that can ruin lives. Soft brain plus hard skull with sharp ridges equals trouble. Traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, are a major cause of psychiatric illness, and few people know this because most psychiatrists never look at the brain. TBI has been linked to homelessness, drug and alcohol abuse, anxiety, panic attacks, depression, ADD, ADHD, learning problems, school failure, murder, suicide, domestic violence, job failure, and incarceration. In a study I did at Sierra Tucson, a psychiatric hospital in Arizona, 44% of new admissions had a significant history of brain injury. In another study of homeless people in Toronto, 58% of the men and 42% of the women had had a significant brain injury before they became homeless. At the time of this writing, more than 300,000 veterans have sustained a TBI since 2000. The effects of such injuries can follow people for the rest of their lives, indicating that it's likely those veterans and society will feel the consequences for many decades to come. 2 million new TBIs occur each year as a result of falls, accidents, and concussions. We have to do a much better job of preventing TBIs and repairing the brain once they occur. When President Barack Obama and LeBron James, both huge sports fans, said they would not let their children play tackle football, it was a sign that awareness about the effects of TBI are starting to become part of our cultural fabric. 5. Many things hurt the brain. Obviously, drugs, too much alcohol, infections, environmental toxins, and traumatic head injuries are bad for your brain. But research also tells us that obesity, sleep apnea, hypertension, and even high normal blood pressure levels, diabetes, prediabetes, and even high normal blood sugar levels, many medications such as benzodiazepines, the standard American diet, SAD, filled with processed foods, pesticides, sugar, and artificial colors and sweeteners, unbalanced hormone levels, chronic stress, negative thinking, even spending time with unhealthy people are all bad for the brain. Take a moment to think how many of these factors might be affecting you. 6. Many things help the brain. The exciting news is that many things are also good for your brain and can boost its function, such as learning new things, great nutrition, coordination exercises, meditation, loving relationships, and certain nutrients, including vitamins B6, B12, and D, methyl tetrahydrofolate, omega-3 fatty acids, and phosphatidylserine. In many ways, the best thing you can do for your brain is to spend time with healthy people. As we will see, they are contagious. I often say the fastest way to get healthy is to find the healthiest person you can stand and then spend as much time around him or her as possible. Chapters 19 and 20 will give you a detailed description of what you can do to enhance your brain. 7. Certain systems in the brain tend to do specific things, and problems in these systems tend to cause symptoms that can benefit from targeted treatments. Knowing about your brain can help you understand yourself and others. This is one of the main areas of focus for this book. You'll learn about the 5 major brain systems involved with feelings, thinking, and behavior, including the limbic or emotional brain, mood and bonding, basal ganglia, motivation, pleasure, and anxiety, prefrontal cortex, the brain's CEO, focus, forethought, and judgment, anterior cingulate gyrus, detects errors and helps you shift attention, and the temporal lobes, memory, learning, and mood stability. Specifically, we will look at the latest research about what each system does, what happens when things go wrong, and how to help them. 8. Looking at the brain gives us the opportunity for many powerful insights, not possible by just listening to symptoms alone. After looking at more than 100,000 brain scans, we know that if you don't look at how the brain functions in individual patients, you are really just guessing at what's wrong with them. Without imaging an individual's brain, physicians miss important causes of cognitive, emotional, or behavior problems, such as brain injuries, toxic exposures, or infections. People end up misdiagnosed and mistreated. Adriana, age 16, went on a mountain vacation with her family. When they arrived at their cabin, they were surrounded by 6 deer. It was a beautiful moment. 10 days later,